sit down this week getting ready for Acts chapter 24, if you want to go ahead and turn there. Paul finds himself where he left off with facing his accusers there that were Felix. I can't help but notice some similarities in my study on this. And so when Donnie asked me to fill in because I'm on a different train of thought than Donnie was, I kind of went back and caught myself back up to where we are standing here with Ananias and the elders and all those that were accusing Paul. It helps me understand things better. Couldn't help but notice some of the similarities that you see today. I was talking to Bernice earlier. Ecclesiastes 1:9. There's nothing new under the sun. And when you start dividing what's going on here in chapter 24 with Paul, and you look at what we see in the world today, nothing changes. It's all the same. God's addressed it. He's helped us. And no doubt, we'll benefit ourselves if we go back and look at that with it in our mind to see that that's the case. It'll benefit us greatly. Paul, if you'll remember, was arrested when he came into Jerusalem. That was in chapter 21 and verse 33. Mentioned back in 21 and verse 17 there that when Paul got to Jerusalem, if you'll remember, he had been warned, hadn't he? Remember the elders at Ephesus? Remember Agabus that prophesied his binding? Paul knew what was waiting for him when he came into Jerusalem. But he comes into Jerusalem, and it says there in 21:17 that he was received gladly. The church received him. The elders received him gladly. Things were good. The problem was in verse 27, when you look in 21, was that now when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him. Make a mental note of that. These hearings are no different than the hearings that we have in court. Who has stirred the crowd up? Who has caused the problem? The Jews. The Jews from Asia. Because we're going to look at the accusers later in 24 and see what they accuse Paul of. And I think you'll start seeing some parallels there. So they come in, they stir him up, even to the point that they wanted to kill him. They wanted to try to take his life. And had it not been for the Romans stepping in and rescuing him, they would have killed Paul there. But he was sustained by the providence of God through Lysias or the commander there and some of the guards. So Paul, in chapter 22, recounts, he gets to speak to the crowd and plead with the crowd. So keep that in mind. That's number one. Paul is defending himself before the crowd, number one. They don't like what Paul's got to say. Is it because he stirred up the crowd and caused a mob and tried to kill somebody? No, it's they did that. He just brought the gospel to them. He brought truth to them and they didn't like it. They say he's not fit to live because he hits on Jesus Christ and the resurrection. These are all things that are hitting nerves with them. So Paul ends up before the centurion to be scourged. We see that in 22:24. He gives his defense to him there. Second time Paul's had to defend himself. He brings out that fact in 22 and verse 25, I think it is. Let's see. Yeah, I think it's 22:25. Where he claims his Roman citizenship. It says, and abounding with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? He had rights just like we have rights today in our systems. And that's what Paul's pleading to. Now, I don't like to skip ahead too far because I don't want to spoil things later on. God put them in order for a reason. But I can't help but think about 25 and verse 11. When Paul says, I'm an offender or have committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. But if there's nothing in these things of which men accuse me of, no one can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar. That comment that Paul makes sets in motion. Really, he's already in motion with the Roman government. But that pretty much sets him on course to Rome. There's no other way to end up but at Rome. And if you go on over chapter 26 and verse 32, Paul gives, we're going to look at four defenses that he gives. We've already counted two. That's not counting Festus that comes after Felix and Agrippa that we see here in verse 32. Then Agrippa said to Festus, "This man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar." Paul's things could have ended. But Paul activated his rights to go to Caesar. So God's playing his will out. Christ has told him, you know, it's going to be for you to make it to Rome, and here's how they're getting him there through these defenses. His third defense we see in chapter 22 and verse 30 through part of chapter 23 is to the Sanhedrin. You'll often see him referred to as the council. It's the Sanhedrin council. We see there that Ananias has showed up. Ananias is the high priest. Paul calls him a whitewashed wall in verse 3 of chapter 23, which stirs a nest as well, but he didn't recognize him as the high priest. But Paul, Donnie mentioned this, and it's so smart on Paul's behalf. Of course, the Holy Spirit is acting through Paul. They divided the Pharisees and the Sadducees against one another right there. That's all Paul had to do. But Paul's bringing out a point that he's going to bring out even better later on. And the point is, you all, as Pharisees and Sadducees, you all are of the Jewish faith, and you all have differences. You don't mob, you don't kill each other, is the point that he's making. I don't have a difference. I believe in the resurrection, he goes on to explain later on. I just believe the prophecy and the prophets in whole, where you all cut it off and refuse to accept Christ and the rest of the prophecy and the rest of the prophets. That's the point he's making. He's going to make it more clear later on. But that's when Christ says in 23 and verse 11, "Be of good cheer, Paul. For as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome." And that's already in the making. We looked at that. He's already activated that. Christ wants him in Rome. So Paul's rushed to the barracks for safety in 23 verse 10. This oath by the 40 to kill him comes out in 23 verse 12. Make a mental note of that. Who's trying to kill who here? Because these accusations that come up later don't fit what we see happening. So Paul's sent to Felix, a governor, by night. We see that in chapter 23, verse 23 through 33. That means he has to go to Caesarea, because that's where the governor Felix sits, is in Caesarea. So he's rushed out. He's taken down there for his hearing, which will be his fourth defense that he'll have to give before this governor Felix is going to hear him. And Paul's held by Felix down there until the accusers come and face him. Very similar to what we have today. We have the right in our own judicial system to face our own accusers. That's a right that we're established today as Americans, and Rome was no different. Look at 23 and verse 35. He said, "And I will hear your after your accusers have come." He mentioned that, but Felix holds him there, and it takes like 5 days for these accusers to come in here. All right, now we're to chapter 24. Our memories are refreshed. We see what actually happened, truly happened, the facts that should come out in a hearing. We see those established. And we're going to start in chapter 24 and look at what the testimony, how it fares up or weighs out with the facts that happen. 5 days, we pick up chapter 24. Look at his accusers. Who are his accusers there in chapter 24? Three different ones mentioned. I know we don't have a number because we don't have any elders, but there was the high priest, which was Ananias. It was the elders and a certain orator. Some translations may have terminology that's closer to lawyer or something like that, because that's what this guy was an orator or a speaker in a court proceeding here. These gave evidence to the governor against Paul. So there's his accusers, there's who couldn't. Now Ananias, that's no big surprise, is it? He's already bumped heads with Ananias. He's already called him a whitewashed wall. Ananias is in with all the rest of them that want to kill him, want to get rid of him. The elders, let's say a word about that, because many people who don't study the history of Israel, when they see elder, they get confused. Let's not forget, there's at least three elders, different kinds of elders, mentioned in God's Word. Number one is the Jewish elder, or the elder that was in the Jewish faith, the government. I think about them, and I think about going back to Exodus 3, verses 16 and 18. And we see there that in Exodus 3, 16 and 18, these elders were recognized, and this is even before Moses. We know later on that Moses comes along and Jethro offers him advice to set people to judge them and their problems. I don't know that that's what we have here, but Moses later on uses people to judge, sets judges over the people to take care of their civil matters and whatnot. But we know back before Moses in Exodus 3 that judges existed in the Jewish structure. They assisted in the government and running in the government, Numbers 11, 16 through 25. Curiously, when you look at 2 Samuel 3:17, you see that the judges were instrumental in deciding the king. So they were very, very had a big role in the Jewish faith. These are Jewish elders. And they tried civil cases, Matthew 26, verse 3. That's why I think, you know, Moses comes along and puts judges over the people too. Could be the same judges, but we know judges existed before then. So here, that's the Israel or the Jewish judges. We also have judges, elders. We also have elders in the church, don't we? Remember in 21:17 in Acts when we read, they gladly received Paul, didn't they? The church. That's two different elders. The Israel's elders, the Jewish elders, and the elders of the church. They had gladly received him. Been no problems. Paul even mentions here in a minute, I spoke, I taught in your synagogues, your cities, your temple, since I've been in Jerusalem. I've not had any problems. And there hadn't been any problems with him. He was gladly received by the elders of the church and the brethren that were there. Brethren that's later going to get called a sect by these people because they hate them. There's also elders mentioned in heaven. Revelations 4:4. So that's at least three that we can put our fingers on of elders that are mentioned. Know your elders. These elders that are here with Ananias are these Jewish elders. Think of their history. Their past history with Christ and with the apostles, we see that they are very capable of formulating false witnesses, building these false defenses, doing all these things to try to kill, to get rid of their problems, You see the corruption that's within all of that. The last one, or the third one, was this orator, or this type of lawyer, Tertullus. I think I'm pronouncing that right. I'm not sure. But the stage is set. Here's the four things that we look at. The four accusations that this Tertullus makes. Now you could tell this man, where Paul said, you know, that he was not a great speaker, not great with words. But you can tell this guy makes his living with his words. He calms this situation as he stands up. He bows to Felix, and he really courts Felix and compliments him and sets the stage to make these accusations. Let's look at that. And when he called upon, verse 2 of chapter 24, and when he called upon Tertullus, Tertullus began his accusation, saying, "See that through you we enjoy great peace, prosperity brought to this nation by you. We accept it always in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness." That's our greetings, our pleasantries. We'll get that over with. "Now, nevertheless, to not be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear by your courtesy a few words from us. For we have found this man, number one, a plague. Number two, a creator of dissension among the Jews throughout the world. Number three, a ringleader of the sect." Now, I kind of broke that in along with this verse 6 for number 4. "He even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law." So the four accusations are now set. I went back and I thought about Paul and his life and all that he did. And it's amazing. It's amazing what the Holy Spirit did through him. He was called a plague. In their eyes, a plague. It was a plague. But he literally turned the world upside down. What a blessing. He took the gospel to the world and he saved souls for eternities. Uncountable. The work that he did and the good fruit that came from it. To them, that's a scourge or a plague. But in reality, he was a blessing. So see, he's portrayed as the opposite of what he is. When in fact, they are the plague that's trying to quieten, squash the gospel of Christ. They just switch it. All right, second one, a creator of dissension. We took a little minute there as we read, refreshed our memories on what all had happened there. Who was the ones that caused the dissension? The Jews. More specifically, they noted the ones from Asia who came in, who righted the people, caused the stir, caused the dissension. The dissension and all the problems and the rioting, the mobs, the attempted murders, all that was from them. All Paul was doing was proclaiming the gospel to the world. That's all he was doing. And because they hated that, they portray him as a creator of dissension when it's them who are doing all the works of violence, the false witnesses, and all this other stuff. He's accused of being a ringleader of the Nazarene sect. I don't know about you all, but when I saw that word Nazarene, what does that automatically bring to your mind? What's associated with the Nazarene? Yeah, that vow. That Nazarene vow. That was a great and wondrous thing. I mean, that was a very, very... That was a person that was especially consecrated to God. They took these vows and they were very strict. At one time, it was a thing of greatness to them, to the Jews. And now, as you see things play out, I'm reminded in 1 John 40-something, I think, were Nathanael or something, says, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" Look at the change that's happened because of their resistance and their fight against the gospel to try to stop Christ, stop His gospel. Now they're referred to as a sect, a Nazarene sect. And that's simply because they know that's Christ's origin, was Nazareth. Christ being from Nazareth, Christ being preached and taught to the world that He was resurrected from the dead and the Son of God, has caused Nazareth to now become something that was a scourge or looked down upon. They're destroying their own beliefs, their own things, because of Christ. All in for everything. Anybody got anything you want to say about that? That's just my thoughts, but I mean, it is scripturally backed up.
Yeah, Brian.
Is the Nazarene and the Nazarite vow the same thing?
Well, the name is what I'm saying. You know, the Nazareth was a place
right, where
Christ came from, and there was a Nazarene vow. But
is that the same as the Nazarite vow? Or I know they seem like they probably have the same root origin.
Yeah. I don't know, Brian. I don't know. It just came to my mind when I saw the Nazarene sect,
yeah, that
there was a Nazarite vow that was a good thing, and now the name Nazarite or Nazarene
okay, has
got this horrible connotation to it now. It came to my mind about how that had really flipped, especially when you look at 1 John there when Nathanael or whatever... His last name, it ends funny, it's Nathanael something, that says, "Has anything good ever came from Nazareth?"
Yeah, one of the apostles said that.
Yeah. No, I think it was, well, yeah. Who?
Yeah, just Nathanael.
Okay.
Anything good come from Nazareth?
Yeah. But the point I'm making is Christ coming from Nazareth has now made this a place that's looked at in a dim light, a horrible light by the Jews. The fourth accusation that was made against him is he tried to profane the temple. Go back to Acts 21. We probably could have looked at this earlier and established this, but go back to Acts 21 and 27 through 30. It says, "Now when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews from Asia, seeing him, came and stirred him up," because he's been there 7 days in their synagogue, cities, and temple, "crying out, 'Men of Israel, help. This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people, the law, and in this place.'" Remember that, because they're accusing him of teaching against the law. We're going to look at what he's teaching here in a minute. "And furthermore, he also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." 29, "For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple." They didn't even know that. They've accused him of that. Anything to try to shed him in a different light. But it's funny that in that attempt to try to make him something bad there, they mentioned that he taught, who teaches all men everywhere against the law. Keep that in mind. Because we know that Paul, when he went to Jerusalem, he went through that cleansing vow. He did that. We talked about the reasons for that. Different reasons. You can look at that different. But Paul tried to cleanse himself to make himself palatable, I guess, or able to have the audience of the Jewish people there. Did everything he could do to keep from causing problems with the Jews, I guess is what I'm trying to say, and yet they were the ones that came after him to kill him and to cause him the problems. Something else these accusers did. The accusation against Lysias, the commander. Remember what they said there about him? Said, look at verse 7 of chapter 24. "But the commander, Lysias, came by and with great violence took him out of our hands." Who was the violence? When Lysias had to step in, they were about to kill him. They were about to kill Paul. They were about to draw and quarter him. They were going to destroy him. Lysias didn't come in with violence. Lysias came in to squash violence, to stop violence. Nothing new under the sun. Sounds like a court proceeding. Took him out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you. By examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him. There's nothing wrong with bringing accusers there. Lysias was saving a man that was about to be killed by a mob, an unruly mob that was causing dissension and problems, and delivering him into the system that gave him the right to face his accusers. But they want to paint this picture of Lysias to Felix as this bad guy that stepped in on us with violence and took him and made us jump through all these hoops to come down here to you, to sit down with you, and to be heard about these things. The same thing we see today. Nothing new under the sun. The same tricks that men use today. Also notice that it mentioned there in verse 9, and some of these things, you know, like the Nazarite thing, I apologize for not looking into that more. Brian's brought that out. We will look into that more. The Jews also assented, maintaining that these things were so. They brought their pep rally, their pep crowd with them. Go back and look at Christ and how they handled Christ. Go back and look at how they handled the apostles in the past. We've already mentioned some of those examples of what these crowds, what these elders, what these high priests, what these people were willing to do to falsely accuse someone or to get rid of them. I wrote down just a few things here. Matthew 26. Go back to Matthew 26, 3 and 4. Then the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest. Here's the high priest, another audience with him, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. That's the caliber of people that we have sitting here. Jump over to verse 59 and 60 of the same chapter. Now the chief priests, the elders, there they are, and all the council, there's your Sanhedrin council, sought false testimony against Jesus Christ to put him to death. That's what their history proves of them. I'm not accusing them. I'm showing you what they do. It's facts, how they handle things. Of course, they found none in this case, but it wasn't from lack of effort. And even though many false witnesses did come forward, they found none, evidently, that would fit what they needed to do. But at last, two false witnesses came forward and said, this fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. It just kind of shows us a little bit about the character of these people that stand before him and accuse him. So Paul gets his defense. That's number 4. We're now, Paul's got his opportunity to talk in chapter 24. So he gets to lay his defense. What does he say first? Well, one of the first things that I found, or I mentioned, it's 12 days since Paul went to Jerusalem to worship. Remember, he had 7 days there, and he spent 5 days here waiting on his accusers to come to Caesarea. So that's 12 days. But he's in Jerusalem 7 days to worship. He brings out the fact there was no disputing, no inciting of anything in the temple, in the synagogues, or in the cities. He's merely given Felix the facts. All these things I've been accused of, that didn't happen. I didn't do that. I was gladly received in just preaching and teaching. I was causing no dissension. The dissension, in other words, is on the Jews' behalf for coming in and trying to bust up everything and kill me. But he does make a confession. He mentions down there when it comes to this, the sect that he's accused of, nor can they prove the things of which they accuse me. But I confess to you, verse 14 of chapter 24, that according to the way, and the way is this gospel that he preaches, this group, the church, they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and the prophets. To me, that's one of the most powerful verses in this chapter. Because he's showing them, I am you, I am one of you, I believe all things that are written in the law and by the prophets. That's what differentiates me from you, my accusers. They were all Jews, Paul and all of them, but they refused to accept the fact that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and that he was resurrected from the dead. And for that, they were going to extinguish him. They were going to extinguish his teachings. And there, nothing else would ever go any farther than that. They would keep their government in place. All those things would happen. But Paul brings out the fact, I believe all the things that the prophets said. In other words, you all are lacking. I am more of what the prophets write than you are, and more of the law than you are, because they accused him of speaking against the law. Paul never spoke against the law. Paul knew what the law was for. He knew why it was there. And he knew Christ had brought that to fulfillment. And now the gospel is to be preached, and we're in the latter days. He knew that. They were the ones who didn't follow their own prophecies and their own writings. He said, so I worship. Verse 15, I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. These are the things that just strike their nerves, especially the Sadducees, who don't believe in angels, don't believe in resurrection, don't believe in angels, all this stuff. So, he accepts this hope in God. He says, this being so, I myself always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men. He's got no fight with them. He's got no fight with God. He's just proclaiming the truth. That's all he's about. They just can't accept this fact that they have killed the Son of God, that he was the Savior that came to earth, and they're going to cut their prophecy, their writing, and their law off so that they don't have to go any farther about anything. He had a good conscience toward God and men. He's mentioned that before. Verse 21, and I'll quit. Here's where he's summing it up. He's bringing it to rubber meets the road. Unless it is for this one statement which I cried out, standing among them concerning the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged by you this day. That's what he's being judged about. That's what he's being killed for. The resurrection of the dead. The resurrection of Jesus Christ, proving him the Son of God. We'll tell Donnie that we ended there next week. Does anybody got anything they want to add? Anything else I need to clear up? We'll look into the Nazarite thing too. Thank you.